This is CliffCentral.com.
Alrighty, it's time for the Burning Platform, which is brought to you every week by Nando's. This is where we get to talk about all the things that are going on in the country and in the world. It's a place where we can discuss politics, we can discuss the economy, we can discuss society, and we can discuss some of the things in the news. Canton Pillay is with us, Pumi Mashiko, Sia Sangweni, and you. So if you've got something to say, 079-748-2090. Morning, Canton. How are you?
Sia always tends to take pictures of us in the most inappropriate positions possible. I think he really gets off on this stuff. By the way, guys, you know the poem that you're talking about, Kipling's If,
yes,
was quoted by the trial judge in Jacob Zuma's rape trial in his final judgment.
Oh.
He said, if you can do these things, you'll be a man, my son.
Huh.
Yes.
That is a random piece of information, though, that I'm glad to
know. It's a hell of a poem.
It's a hell of a poem. Of course, you know, today Kipling is a fundamental representation of toxic masculinity, the patriarchy, yeah, colonialism, sure, all of that kind of stuff.
Well, go and read that poem and tell me you wouldn't want your son to grow up like that.
Are you assuming your son's gender?
Yeah,
I think I am. Canton, please.
All right. First of all, honorable mention for Canton Pillay yesterday during our pure conversation with Spoo and Fresh and Touch and Robert Marawa and Trevor Gumby. Some very nice things said about YFM and your involvement there in the early days of, you know, your contribution to radio. So it was nice that we get to see you the day after that came up.
Thanks, guys. I'm waiting to listen to that podcast myself.
Good stuff. So, great. Where do you feel like starting today? We've got a lot on the plate. We've got overseas, we've got Boris is in, we've got Robert Mueller testifying again in front of Congress. We'll talk about what came up or what didn't. We could talk locally about Gedleligisa, we could talk about the State Capture Commission, we could talk about the Public Protector, we could talk about Pravin, we could talk about Derek Hanekom. There's lots. Where do you want to start?
I want to start with Boris.
Okay.
I loved Boris's speech. Did you guys
actually? What did Boris say? What did he say?
He said the buck stops here. He said, come hell or high water, we will be out by the 31st of October.
Brexit will happen.
Yes, Brexit will happen.
All right, well, here he is. Let's listen to it, because then everybody can hear it in his own words. His first speech as Prime Minister.
I've just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, who has invited me to form a government, and I have accepted. And we will do a new deal. A better deal that will maximise the opportunities of Brexit while allowing us to develop a new and exciting partnership with the rest of Europe based on free trade and mutual support. I have every confidence that in 99 days' time we will have cracked it. And though I am today building a great team of men and women, I will take personal responsibility for the change I want to see.
I love people who take personal responsibility, even if I think they're a bit weird. And he's a bit weird. There's no doubt. He's an eccentric, strange human being. Very English in every way. But if someone says if I could say to Sia, I need you to handle this, and he goes, I will take personal responsibility for this. You know what I like, Sia?
That's a commitment.
Yeah, I envision you saying that quite frequently, Sia.
Well, if, Canton.
Let's talk about a couple of things that were not in that clip, okay? First of all, there's this whole thing that Boris Johnson's a racist. Okay, take a look at his cabinet. Who's his finance minister? He's a Muslim.
Okay.
Okay, his home secretary is an Indian woman. He's got another, well, she'd get quite upset, Preeti Patel, if I referred to her as Indian, because she's British, damn it.
And, right.
Yes, but yes, she's of Indian ancestry, and there's another person in his cabinet of Indian ancestry. He came down very strongly in his opening speech about LGBT rights.
Mm-hmm.
All of the stuff that this guy is being accused of.
But Canton, yes. I think everybody knows, this is kind of the unspoken thing, that when someone on the far left calls you a racist, it's usually not true. It's really that they've run out of other material.
Yeah, but it needs to be said, because just about every bit of discourse that comes out about this guy says that he's a racist, and it says that he's anti-gay, and goes on this absolute bloody
tirade. But they said the same thing about Trump, and they're comparing Trump and Boris the whole time and trying to ridicule them both as being these pariahs.
He was channeling
Trump was the only guy who was openly in support of gay marriage his entire life. He's never said anything other than that he supports gay marriage. Hillary only changed on that about 5 or 6 years ago. Barack Obama, halfway through his presidency, changed his mind on gay marriage. And these were the Democrats. So people have to take you at your word sometimes, and then also look at what your deeds are to figure out whether or not you're supposedly a virtuous person.
Well, but as Kenton was just trying to say, that he was channeling Trump.
There's what did he say?
Well, he said a new deal, a better deal. This was like exactly the words that were used on the Iran nuclear deal by Trump.
Speaking of the Iran nuclear deal, as he is 99 days, Brexit will happen.
Yeah.
And there they are in that strait needing.
Strait of Hormuz.
So let me make
in
a
the
couple
strait of Hormuz needing Europe to come in.
Let me make a couple of predictions up front now.
All right.
Okay. Mike Pence is going to be visiting shortly before the 31st of October.
Mm-hmm.
I strongly suspect that Mike Pence and Boris Johnson are going to announce a significant trade deal between the US and the UK. So that's the first prediction that I'm making. The second prediction is one of the things that Boris Johnson was saying, that he really supports the China's Belt and Road Initiative. And I can see a significant trade deal being announced between the UK and China, which is currently not possible under EU rules.
Huh.
Yes. And I also suspect that there's going to be lots of bilateral deals cropping up with the African continent.
Yes.
Yes.
So these will be good for Britain, they'll be good for all those other respective countries, and it'll make the EU feel less and less significant.
Absolutely. So, and let's not forget, you had the Irish Prime Minister shooting his mouth off yesterday, saying
about that hard border that will then exist in Northern Ireland.
And he says that if Boris thinks he's going to renegotiate it, he's got another thing coming. Actually, Ireland, you know, will come whimpering to the negotiating table, because 43% of their revenue, of their export revenue, comes from the United Kingdom. So, really, you know, this blustering of and pandering to Brussels is really stupid.
I had Lord Peter Hain on yesterday, who, you know, has been an interesting man to talk to over the years. Certainly his stance in the anti-apartheid movement and so on has made him an interesting person in South Africa. But he kind of ran out of steam yesterday, because he was saying, oh no, we need a second referendum. He sounded lukewarm about Jeremy Corbyn. But it seems to me like when, by the end of the conversation, we discussed liberal internationalism, and we discussed the fact that you've got all of these governments that are starting to find people like Boris and Bolsonaro and so on interesting and entertaining, and that people are starting to see these people as the best option, that really the argument of people like Lord Peter Hain is starting to wear thin. And this idea of Europe being enormously powerful, the super state of the EU, is just an illusion.
It's an absolute illusion. Sorry, Pumi, you go.
No, but also, because Theresa May was so tepid in kind of giving a clear direction of where we're going, what's going to happen if Boris does, as Kenton's predictions, announce all these trade deals, people will start to feel far less kind of precious about the fact that maybe Brexit is a bad idea. Right now, they feel like it's a bad idea because they cannot see what is the alternative. And Theresa May, you know, lovely dancer as she may be, was just not giving any kind of direction. So people were feeling like, where are we going? What are we doing? What does this mean? Is this going to happen?
Your point is correct. But the absolute problem with Theresa May is that she was always against Brexit. That was the problem.
Yeah, but
so when she called a snap election after Cameron resigned and was expecting support, everyone actually said, no, you know, you're the person who was always opposed to Brexit, so we're not going to vote for you. And she cost them their majority in Parliament.
Yeah.
And Boris, from the get-go, was always in favor of Brexit. he was very strongly in favor of.
Can we cast our minds back to when Cameron did leave and Boris was a serious contender and he removed himself from contention? Do you think he had a long game in mind?
I think he had a long game in mind. I think at that particular time, he knew that he wasn't going to be able to go up successfully against because it was the two Theresas. It was Theresa May. I forget who was the other one.
Yeah, doesn't matter.
Yes, yeah. But at the time, yeah, the timing really sucked for him. I'm convinced of that.
Yeah, and he also, I think he needed to kind of step back, strategize, and plan where he's going to go and how he's going to hit it. It's like you know, these things are always politics is nice because of that, because you can have a long game, and if you have good clear strategy behind you, he probably also had to clean up some stuff that he didn't want people to kind of bring up when he was. So he needed that.
But he was also going through a messy divorce. Remember,
he needed to clean up.
Why do you think people, a lot of people, and I've got friends on social media who are of all political persuasions. I think we all should, but most of my friends are. They're doing what is expected here, that they're ridiculing Boris's hair and comparing him to Trump and all of this stuff. It seems an acceptable prejudice to have against these alpha males, and they are alpha males. I mean, Boris and Trump are both these guys who get shit done in their own private lives. They've had all kinds of challenges which they largely keep to themselves. They're controversial people because they say what they think a lot of the time. They get things done. Boris has had a very successful life and career up to now. He is, like none of us, is a model citizen, but he's an interesting guy. He certainly wasn't a career politician, which I think speaks in his favor. Why is it that people jump immediately to making them ridiculous? Is it because there are so many people who are threatened by this kind of thing that they actually are worried that Boris might get something done? Or is it because they are ridiculous people?
Well, it ties in with the discussion that you guys were having earlier about, you know, people who just want to keep their heads down and not say anything that flies against popular opinion. And the trouble is right now that we have a lot of otherwise intelligent people whose sole source of information on how the world is supposed to work comes from The Guardian.
Mm.
And when that shapes your worldview, you end up constantly needing to find some sort of affirmation that those views actually have some validity. And the way in which you do that is by just constantly parroting the same line. And those of us who think otherwise, actually, we don't engage, just simply because, you know, it's kind of like discussing religion. You're never going to get anywhere.
So I saw an ad on CNN. They were obviously talking about the presidential campaign, and it's one of the ads that are being run. Fascinating how in America you can just be hard and tough against various
those attack ads.
That attack ad on Trump, you know, that ABC kind of A is for whatever and R is for racist and rapist and da da da.
Yeah.
And just looking at that ad, I was thinking, all of these things, this is what was said before Trump was even elected.
And he
still
got elected.
That time, yeah. And he still got elected. Why? Because people don't care. That shit doesn't work. The people who care about that kind of stuff aren't going to do anything outside because they're not wanting to get shot down.
But this is interesting. I mean, I don't think we've really discussed the squad at any length, but we did mention them the other day. These are the four congresswomen.
Four horsewomen of the apocalypse.
That's what Trump calls them. But this is Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. These four women have been, you know, mocked and ridiculed to some degree by the opposite forces. But the problem isn't people who've already decided and who are going to vote the way they've decided on the right and on the left. The audience, these people, whether they are attacking Trump or they're attacking the four congresswomen, they need to get these middle-of-the-road voters who are not decided yet. And this kind of hard political rhetoric is not persuasive. It doesn't help.
As you said earlier, it's lost its impact. There's only so many times you can call a person a racist before it loses all validity whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, when you effectively have Kamala Harris calling Joe Biden a racist.
I think everyone has to concede that term has been used to death, and now it has not got the... And remember, this is still a serious problem in the world. Racism is still a proper issue, and an issue which deserves serious attention. What has happened...
Why do we always feel the need to qualify what we are saying by saying that?
But what has happened here is that they've removed all the importance from this term. It's now another moniker like, oh, he's a funny guy, or he's an asshole, or any of these things. It's become watered down to the extent where real racism, which is a problem, is no longer being highlighted the way that it should be. All these dumb issues are being watered into and added to the mix. It's like a big soup where nothing inside really tastes like anything anymore.
But it's also easy, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
It's easy to fall into that space and be like, this is one, you know, and not get into, we were talking earlier about debates and the debates that we have here on Cliff Central. The issue of moving and changing a person's mind is about giving them tangible, real points to consider about what it is that you're saying. So just shooting down the one for the other isn't a thing. But I do understand.
But even appealing to the emotional side, which is something the left is better at than the right usually. The right prefers to appeal to the head. The left appeals to the heart. That's how it works. That's how people are built. That's the way that politics is mostly constructed. But appealing to the emotion means you can't keep on crying wolf in a context of whether it's immigration or racism or any of the stuff that Trump is particularly accused of, but now Boris as well. Because I think people are just, eventually it starts losing its impact and has the opposite effect where people start going, look, can you shut up for a second so I can actually hear what the real issues are? Like the howling from the side, as you called it this morning, Pums. Let's go on to other things locally.
But speaking of Boris and his long game, because we were talking about his long game, it's also fascinating for me to watch Boris's long game. And you can see that this is a guy that deeply thought about what he wants for his presidency or prime ministership or whatever you call it. He knows what he wants. He knows what he's after. He's got his 3, 4, 5 things that he's going to harp on about. That's why he comes out there on 10 Downing Street and is like big on the New Deal. He's big on Brexit. Very different to our President Cupcake, who doesn't seem to know what it is that he wants with his presidency.
Where is our president, by the way?
Well, he was talking about the fact that we must all knuckle down and brace ourselves for a job loss.
What a thing to say.
Directly after when he came out and he was inaugurated, he was like, we're building jobs, Now, look where he is. But... you know, much as we all don't like to say it, you know, when Julius Malema said, this guy has been wanting to be president for how long? But he clearly didn't know what he was going to do when he became the president. This is what we are stuck with.
You're right. no. Cyril said that he was going to create these jobs. And just like the Reserve Bank always revised down the growth rate. And it's kind of like admitting, oh, well, we're crap. But we'll have to brace ourselves being more crap. The president actually had the temerity to come out and say, brace yourself for job losses. What a thing for a leader to say, especially a leader who, Pumi rightly points out, has said he will do something about this. This is defeatism.
Right now, I have to say the only person in government that's actually saying anything coherent is Tito.
What did he say?
Well, Tito, when he was making the announcement around the... the special appropriation yesterday, said, you know, guys, you have to actually recognize that we're paying for this stuff and it has to come from somewhere. And in other words, brace yourself, Sheila.
Tighten your belts.
What's the most likely place to give way in the current political climate? Is it the, because something has to be done. I'm talking about government spending in particular here. Is it likely to be government? In other words, will the fabric of that structure start to crack? Will the unions crack? Will the tax base crack? What's going to happen? Something's got to give. Do you have any predictions in that respect?
I think that from the employment perspective, the unions have pretty much already cracked. And really, this is the opportunity for Cyril to actually be revising labor laws, but he's completely unlikely to do that until it gets to the stage where it is just so impossible that it just kind of happens.
It happens on its own.
Yeah, it's happening on its own. As it is right now, most of the employment that's happening within the country is outside of the formal structure. So in other words, it's cash-based stuff fueled mainly by illegal immigrants who are very happy to accept payment in cash And of course, all of that falls outside of the tax net.
Therefore, which, also outside of the union's grasp.
Yes, all of that. And so that's already happening by and large.
Huh. Speaking of Cyril and the cracks, and I had a really interesting conversation with someone who will remain nameless the other night at the Nelson Mandela Foundation about Cyril. And they were of the opinion that he almost should have, upon his election as president, and particularly after the last election when his power was at probably its greatest fulsomeness, he should have maybe taken advantage of that and had a little bit of a night of the long knives within the ANC, because he would have had power enough then, and there would have been people who were unprepared enough to have been sidelined very quickly. He had that window of opportunity. That window's closed. And we can now see the open rebellion happening with the public protector. We can see all of these other forces gathering against him within his own party. He is not secure in any way. And he had a chance to be secure if he had the balls to act. He didn't.
And
do you agree with that?
Thing, this is the thing about strategy. You know, this and politics is always a game of strategy. What Jacob Zuma inherited from Thabo Mbeki is a structure of government that kind of supported the president. And even within the party, he, you know, it is, Thabo had kind of wrestled that
control
thing into, and Jacob Zuma went about breaking that thing, right? And so where we are now is we are sitting with the president, both in the ANC and in the country, who has no structural support. He has no strategy around him. He's got that support structure for the president does not exist. He does not have people around him who seem to be advising him in the correct ways, in the correct processes.
Well, Tito is advising him
thing,
in the correct way, and he refuses to listen.
but so, I mean, there's an entire support structure that should be around the man. You know, so when you say a night of the long knives,
the support structure will come at the point at which he actually
stands
displays
up
any type of integrity. It's like, you know, Turok sending out a message to him yesterday saying you need to put the country before the prayer before the your party.
We've heard this before.
Yes. And he doesn't.
This tired old drum is being banged again.
Yes. So if we go back to, you know, where the economy is going, the number of immigrants leaving this country, it's unreal. I mean, just count among all of your individual circles. If every week, every single one of us hears about, you know, someone.
I'm talking about social media, and I can see droves of people. It's going to be the ones, it's going to be us. You see me and Pumi left here, Canton, in about 6 months' time by the looks of things. This is obviously, these are people who can leave, who first of all have somewhere else to go and have the money to go there. These are not people who are stuck. These are not people who are unemployed, who are in need of something to do, who are unproductive people necessarily. These are people who get shit done and have made a decision that they're abandoning ship.
Was it Argentina in the early 2000s that had three presidents in the space of what? 18
in rapid
months?
Succession, yes.
18 months. Yeah. I mean, the one president lasted all of a month because the people had had enough, you know. So the people had had enough. They came out of this. In fact, they wanted everybody in government to step down and start again.
But if you consider, consider every one of those migrants, Pumi, who leaves, if they are earning, let's say, on the order of 100,000 rand a month, remember that the better part of 45,000 rand a month from that is going directly to the fiscus. Mm. Now that's money that's lost forever.
Right.
It's not coming back.
Yeah. And they don't seem to appreciate that this is a problem. I mean, you still have people in the ANC saying, if people want to go, let them go.
Yes.
You know, it's like Donald Trump saying, if Ilhan Omar does not agree with me, she can go. It's not a helpful thing to say.
No.
It shows that you've got very short-term thinking.
And because we're on earlier with the, you know, with the clever quotes, I read something a little bit a couple of days ago, and I didn't know who Will Durant was until he's a historian, American historian, died in 1981. Animals eat one another without qualm. Civilized men consume one another by due process of law. And that's where we are. Like, the ANC is eating itself up from inside. The government is eating itself up, and it's all law. It's all Pravin versus Mkhwebana. It's this versus who? It's commissions of inquiry. It's the PIC.
And they're using
the law.
Things that are meant to aid progress to impede it.
The law is consuming us all. You know, we're just...
Well, again, something's got to give here as well. And it might be Cyril. Maybe Cyril's gone. Now, what do we have if, let's say, the factions get their way and they manage to oust Cyril and he sits there like a jelly baby and lets it happen? What are we then left with?
Well, we have President Didi, obviously.
Waiting in the
Which is fantastic, right? Because then you're going to see capital flight like you've never seen in your life.
Yes, absolutely.
That will be the end of our economy. Do the ANC not realize the urgency of this problem?
No,
is it so important for them to fight for power over nothing that they're willing to reduce what they try to get power
over?
But
it's the entire premise around the National Democratic Revolution. It has always been the case. Show me a single communist state in the world that has not gone down that path. So if you look at North Korea, you look at Venezuela.
No sacrifice is too great.
No sacrifice is too great because...
To achieve the utopian dream.
Yes. You know, the party comes above all else.
Right. Well, okay. So start putting your money into Bitcoin and gold.
Yes. I think one of the really interesting things, and again, you watch the type of discussions that suddenly become more frequent. And at the point at which they began speaking about going after our pension funds, suddenly there's a whole lot of people looking into what is it actually going to cost me to get my pension fund out of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly one of those who's been doing it myself. I've got no intention of leaving the country. But I would rather take the tax hit up front now, get the money outside of the country, where at least I know it's not going to be victim to a free-falling rand. So even if it's costing me, you know, hundreds of thousands in terms of
tax.
The tax hit up front, that probably sounds like something that's going to be more profitable in the long run.
Hmm.
But we now need to start doing those calculations with a great deal of seriousness.
There have to be people with some seriousness in mind who look at the situation, and even if they're in the bureaucracy rather than in the political level of cabinet and all the rest of it, there are people in the Department of Finance, in Treasury, who and in SARS, who must see these things and be reporting them to their political overlords, at least with some degree of concern.
Oh, there's hugely competent people still sitting in these echelons of government. I mean, you know, take Ismail Momoniyet, for example, who has been vilified by the EFF in the past.
Sure, there's a name I haven't heard now, in a while.
Look, I've known Ismail Momoniyet since the 80s. And back then, there was a group of us who used to volunteer to teach classes in Soweto to math students who were not going to school at the time because of the class boycotts. He was one of those people that was teaching them. He was a maths professor at the time in the early 80s. Brilliant guy. You know, the number crunching that he does in terms of what goes on in Treasury is phenomenal. And no doubt he's presented paper after paper that has showed what happens if we go down particular paths. But it actually requires political will for people to act on it. I could go through a process of naming people in various departments that have been, you know, kind of down in the trenches over the years and just solidly doing good work. I mean, all of the departments, except for Labour, of course. Labour is a complete basket case.
Mm.
But certainly transport, you know, the discussion documents that have come out from transport in terms of how to actually fix transport in the country, none of them have ever been acted upon.
Yeah,
I think it's, you know, how do we mobilize to wrestle power back into the, you know, that's where it is. I mean, we have had this in our country before where the government only serves a very few. Thank you, Sia. Where the government only serves you. And the people are, you know, we are the ones that are supposed to wrestle.
Are we going to have a kumbaya moment again?
Are we not having a kumbaya moment? Really, I do think that, you know, I mean, between business and business leaders and us and our everyday thing. So when you are in your, we cannot be trying to keep our heads down and trying to not cause a stir, trying to not let anybody, you know what I'm saying? Is you've got to be, this is where you fight for this country. This is where you, we all have to wrestle the power away from this madness.
But I'll say this much, okay? When it hits the fan, there is no one better than South Africans in terms of actually making a plan. really.
So you almost sound like you want that to happen.
He's ready for his kumbaya moment. It is happening.
It's not a kumbaya moment. It's got everything to do with the fact that the total collapse of government, which is pretty much inevitable, actually
could open up opportunities and possibilities.
It's already opening up opportunities and possibilities. And the sooner people actually get their heads around it, the sooner that we can actually start making plans that actually involve cutting ourselves loose from government. So if you look in terms of people who are now looking at plans in terms of homeschooling as an example, it's probably the single biggest example that I can think of right now.
Let's not even go to homeschooling, but you can see this move away to you know, look at Advitech's share price and the fact that they're opening up these private colleges everywhere and all levels, primary, tertiary, and secondary education are all being given facilitation by private interests because people do not trust the state system anymore.
Correct. It's the private schools that are springing up in the townships.
That's right.
And again, affordable from the point of view of people who live in those townships because they have greater trust in those people from their own communities who are running those facilities than they do in terms of government being able to deliver.
So it could end up being a bit of a libertarian dream.
This is the best case scenario. So when Canton says they used to go into the townships and teach, that's what that is. That's individuals within society
taking
going, this is how we want the future to look. We are not happy with the system of education that this government is providing people. Therefore, we're going to provide our own. And that collective consciousness and that collective, we're going to do something about it. We're not going to have like this messiah complex and wait for the next president of the ANC who is going to do this, because it's not coming up until that time. Then we each and every one of us stand up and do something in your little corner of the world, you know, do your little garden. Then we'll kind of self-correct towards where we want to be.
Well, it's interesting. I went to a talk the other day, and there was another speaker who we all know very well because he makes a lot of noise on social media about what he's discovered within Eskom, and he was talking about how private power is going to become a big issue. You know, batteries are already something that's on the agenda, but certainly in terms of people putting on solar panels, getting themselves off of the grid, this is ultimately going to lead to Eskom's demise, because even if they raise the prices sky high, they're going to end up with less and less business, because people who can afford to pay their sky-high prices will just install their own electricity, and they'll go off-grid, and they will no longer be in need of Eskom, and therefore Eskom will become this white elephant that it should have become years ago. I'm just trying to remember his name. He's a fairly regular contributor on social media to all the power discussions. And he also said that, you know, it's a dead end for government because they keep pouring money in. The debt keeps going up for Eskom. There's no way out. He doesn't see any way out. And then he did say at the end that the silver lining on this cloud is that battery power and technology are improving, and that ultimately this is the thing that will save us, because people will realize that's more cost effective, and they'll end up putting extra and surplus power into the grid. And government will have to allow it. Private power producers are becoming a major influence on the energy network, and that they'll become an even greater influence going forward. Eskom will only diminish. There's only one path for Eskom, and that is their utter destruction and dismantling.
One of the things that I would be doing if I lived in old parts of Johannesburg, and when I say old parts of Johannesburg, I mean places that have access to Egoli gas, I would look seriously at putting in place gas-fired generators, because then your supply is pretty much guaranteed. And you can do that on a per-home basis.
Yeah, that's not bad. So how else can we go about this? You mentioned education, we've mentioned energy. How should ordinary citizens be cutting themselves loose from government, in your words?
Go off-grid in terms of water supply. That's a crucial thing.
How do you... Boreholes?
Yeah, boreholes. Obviously, rainwater harvesting is something that I think is going to be big, especially in terms of gated communities, because you have the ability to do it there, because you know you've got real estate around the fringes of those high walls.
And space for storage.
Yes, and space for storage, and putting in place pumps to be able to deliver that water. Obviously, going off grid in terms of sewerage becomes important as well. And there again, there's septic tanks that kick in.
Yeah.
And septic tank technology has never actually been better. But the thing that still continues to freak me out is the National Health Insurance Scheme. One of the things that Boris Johnson was saying, he says it's absolutely wrong that you have to wait for 3 weeks to be able to see a doctor in the UK, under National Health in the UK. 3 weeks to see a doctor.
Wow.
Okay, my kid was out of sorts yesterday in the morning. I fire up Discovery app, search for doctor in the immediate vicinity. It pops up a slew of names. I start looking at 20 past 10. I get an appointment at 11 o'clock, and she's seen at 11 o'clock, and I'm out of there.
Yeah, they see that's amazing, and that can only happen in private industry.
Exactly.
Government, we know, cannot run healthcare because healthcare in the public sphere is complete disaster. It is in fact, you are likelier to die in a government hospital than you are to survive.
Absolutely. And if you're not going to die from the incompetence of the people who are treating you, you'll certainly die from infection from the fact that you have nursing staff who are not maintaining basic hygiene.
So is there a way to overcome this? Because if, you know, the private healthcare industry is dismantled and government tries to get their hands on
it.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see on what basis Zweli is going to be able to dismantle, private healthcare industries. Because,
by the way, there are people who come from the UK to South Africa
for medical treatment. Absolutely, yes.
That's how good our private healthcare industry is.
And in fact, medical tourism is something that we should actually be promoting. Mm. You know, come here and get your heart surgery done for a fraction of the cost that you can get it done elsewhere.
Or plastic surgery.
Yeah. Sure, go on safari afterwards. Plastic that's what they do.
Plastic surgery, you need to go to Brazil.
Ah.
Yes, yeah.
But I interrupted you. You were saying Zweli Mkhize is going to have trouble dismantling this.
Well, he's going to have trouble dismantling this because if you look in terms of, Discovery is this, some people think of it as the evil empire. And to a large extent, I tend to agree with some aspects of that. But the medical aid portion of Discovery is actually a cooperative. So what that means is that you're basically a member of a medical scheme mm-hmm. where all of you are participating members. And there's freedom of association component out there that will be really difficult
to crack.
To crack, yes. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure by what process, because that's actually a constitutional issue.
If anything comes out of this current crisis that we have in our government, is that more and more people are going to be interested and in control of their own kind of futures. I looked, Sizwe Medical Aid Scheme had a AGM 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And I was astounded to see the number of people who showed up, ordinary members who showed up to the AGM as they're going through what the... And that's what it means. That's what it means. Because people are now getting to know more about what it is that they have in their control, in their sphere of control. They are participating more. So if anything is going to come out of this crisis, it's going to be that people are going to be more interested in terms of who is around me, who gives me the best service. For one, there are private sector like medical care centers that I will never go to or take my child to because I've been mismanaged in those spaces and actually got the right care at a public institution. So for me, it's about understanding where each particular service that you are needing is at.
Is best.
And being in control of that and not allowing myself to be kind of...
That this choice has ever been anyone's but yours is outrageous. That someone else knows better where you should take your child or someone else knows better where you should have your eyes operated on. This is crazy. This is a very personal decision. Your medical safety and security is a purely personal matter. It has nothing to do with government.
Yes, but government insists on constantly encroaching upon it. So that's where you see
they're
changes.
Only after, let's be fair, they're only after the money here. They don't actually care about how healthy we are.
No, actually it's about removing control. Because if you look firstly in terms of the anti-smoking legislation, it's removing personal choice from people. The anti-drinking regulations that come in, it's removing personal choice. Bringing up a sugar tax, it's about removing personal choice. As opposed to a process of education.
They make it look like they care about you.
Yes.
But you're saying it's just about control.
It's just about control at the end of the day, yes.
But I think that
and protecting your kids is always the excuse that people
aren't
use.
Aren't those days over? It's very hard to do this in the modern world. It's very hard to implement. This is not Soviet Russia.
Gareth, we just had earlier this morning, we just had an entire discussion about the number of kids that are undocumented and just live to fend for themselves because the parents haven't taken the responsibility. And it's in that space. So I think, you know, what I hear Canton saying is one of the things that we're stuck with as well is a level of removing the control from people who want it, who have it, who are taking care of those things, because we have a social situation that has created this huge problem for government where people have abdicated the control. So how do you know, you've got a kind of, to the lowest common denominator when you're a government, you have to go down to the lowest common denominator and try to do something and make rules and controls in society that are going to work for everybody, even though, you know, you're dealing with a Gareth on the one side and you're dealing with...
If what Canton is saying is correct, then all government's going to have left is the lowest common denominator, and you can't extract tax from that. So there will be no reason to have government. So it's a self-defeating idea.
We're very much there already.
Yeah. Okay, so have we got a time scale on this? Have we got an end date? Have we got an Armageddon of government date?
Well, I think
And should we be calm about this, or should we be in the throes of passion and fiery anger?
Well,
you must be in fiery anger, guys.
No. Fiery anger doesn't help, you know? I mean, you know, one of the interesting things that...
Throes of passion and fiery anger.
You know, one of the interesting things that...
Those are the lines from today.
When you see this podcast
description, it'll say throes of passion and fiery anger. Okay, so you were saying...
One of the things that the old man used to say, this is Mandela.
Hmm.
He used to say that you should never utter anything in anger, but you should be seen to be angry, which I think is good advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, Mac Mirage asked him, but, you know, how do you do that? And he said, well, you count to 10 and then you fake it.
Right.
That's brilliant advice.
I went to the launch of Zelda's new documentary that she's put together about, you know, her time with Nelson Mandela. And it was funny, Nkosi Zwelithini Vilile Mandela, who's his grandson, said at the special preview that really, if he thinks about it, Zelda spent more time with his grandfather than anyone else, including either his first wife or his second.
His second or his third,
because his first had predeceased him.
Well, an advocate spent more time with his second wife than he did.
Canton does not shade. So the point being that this woman had spent an inordinate amount of time around this man. I mean, she was telling amazing stories about how she used to carry a little bag of Mealy Pup wherever she went because that's what he liked for breakfast. And they were never searched, although she was always nervous when they would go through customs to these international destinations. Because, you know, a bag of Mealy Pup can be a suspicious-looking thing to carry in your hand luggage.
Except an official passport on the other hand.
Yeah, gets you through everything.
Who's that minister's wife? Okay, no.
Yeah, Shem. Siyabonga Kwele. She was a drug mule. Anyway, it was really interesting to hear all of this because you sometimes need a reminder of how special that period was in so many ways. It suddenly made me think, I remember taking my girlfriend at the time we were at university. I said to her, let's go to the Union Buildings. There was no fancy barricading or security up. We walked around. There's a private garden that's right next to the president's wing of the Union Buildings. If you're looking out from the Union Buildings, on the far right is where the president's office is. Right, in that office with those columns, that's where the state president was. And Nelson Mandela was president then. And I remember saying to her, that's the president's office. We were pointing to it from below. And there was no police presence. There was no feeling of like imminent danger or like we were trespassing. Or it felt like it was the property of all the people of South Africa. And there was something special about that whole... that feeling that we all had, that we had a stake in this.
I know exactly what you're talking about because I went there in 96 and went strolling around myself. Yes.
You did, right? And it felt really good. Yes. And you were like, wow, I want to do this again with my kids or my grandkids or whatever one day. There's no way you can get that close to the building now. You can't even go into some of the gardens, which are supposedly public, because security and danger and, you know, the president.
No, there might be a land grab.
That also. that also
Gareth, you know,
it just made me think those Mandela days, and we all tend, and you know, Mandla also said there are a lot of people who now accuse Madiba of being a sellout and all kinds of things, but politics is compromise, and we could see that with Cyril right now. There's something we've kind of forgotten, and people are want to forget history. They're very quick to deal with the issues of the day and to prioritize those issues because that's how we work. We're a survival instinct driven pattern seeking mammal. We're not very good at looking back and seeing things in the greater context. We've kind of forgotten our own first principles in some of these respects. The ANC's certainly forgotten those first principles, but we as people have forgotten how significant those changes that we wrought were.
But I think, so for me, you know, one of the reasons why I think all of us must have fiery passion is, you know, it starts with the fence at the union buildings. And lo and behold, we have got soldiers in the streets.
Of Cape Town.
In Cape Town. So, and then, you know, those encroaching kind of taking away of freedoms. Where does it end? And who? This is why the passion and the anger and the keeping to account and the being present and not being afraid to speak your mind and hold people around you accountable from your councillor to your ward, what, all of the way to the top, is because if we don't, that's what happens. So suddenly a fence comes up at the union buildings and nobody says, why do our leaders need to be protected from us? What is it that they are afraid of, these leaders of ours?
I mean, arguably, to go back to that example, Mandela was in greater danger from like right-wing extremists. And even if you consider that Chris Hani had been murdered just a few years prior to that, even from within their own ranks in some way, there was opposition. I mean, we know that there were constant fights between Thabo Mbeki and Cyril, and there were arguments between the Alfred Nzo's and the others. You remember these people,
yeah,
right? And so Mandela was holding it all together, but he was there. Right there on the balcony of the building, it was right below. I was not checked for a firearm. There was no suspicion that there would be someone walking around there putting him in danger. And now we see these cavalcades of 20, 30 cars, blue lights and guards with big AK-47, I mean not AKs, R1 rifles and so on. You think, this is unnecessary. You're right. Now the president is probably safer than he's ever been, but he's afraid of his own people more. I mean, I remember, for
what it's worth, Tito was photographed strolling into Parliament without an entourage.
Good for him. Days ago. Good for him. Yeah, I think.
But was he seen at the Woolworths buying pilchards?
Yeah, we've got to have a cook-off between you and Canton.
Was he seen at the Woolworths buying pilchards?
Right,
we haven't seen him cooking his pilchards or any other thing.
Guys, I just want to go
for a long, long time.
I'd like to go back to something that you two were talking about
earlier
in the previous hour, which was the question of aid to Africa.
Yes,
it's a debate.
Sure. Yeah, and one of the people that I follow, you know, I only follow 100 people on Twitter, and it's a thing, and I'm kind of stuck with it now. but one of the 100 is a woman named Dambisa Moyo.
Mm. Yes,
and she's a Zambian by birth, and now she's probably one of the most prominent economists on the world stage. But many years ago, I think it was probably close to 20 years ago, she wrote a book about why aid was absolutely disastrous for Africa, because it just creates this constant cycle of dependence on Western nations and prevents us from actually pulling ourselves up.
There is a TEDx talk that she also did, I think, in Kenya or something like that.
Yeah, but
that's worth looking at.
Worth looking at. Yeah,
absolutely, she's amazing,
and she's a phenomenal intellect. And again, there's no bluster, there's no politicking. It's all about, guys, you know, here's the reality of the economics, and let's just take a look at this and see what we can do with it.
While we're on Twitter, I've just recalled the name of the person who's the energy expert I was talking about earlier, electrical engineer, publisher, and writer. His name is Chris Yelland, and he's the
He's got
EE Publishers. Yeah, he's very good. Really knows more about.
But do you follow him?
What's going on in electricity than almost anyone else in South Africa? So if you're looking, he's the guy to follow there. All right.
Another thing in terms of strategies that people are putting in place good report on Biz News talking about the logistics of transporting icebergs from the Antarctic up to Cape Town.
Why? And,
well, for a water supply. Because because icebergs are fresh water, remember, because you know,
you can pull one up from the Antarctic.
Well, it's something that, look, a number of us have speculated independently about this for years. I wrote about this years ago just as a kind of hypothetical construct. There's a guy on Twitter who's one of the 100 I follow, who's at 6000 6000. He's written about it before, but they've worked out the calculations in terms of actually towing those icebergs, landing them on the Atlantic seaboard outside of Cape Town and using it to provide water. And right now the logistics in terms of the money side of it is actually making a lot of financial sense. So again, you know, in terms of plans where one is able to reduce dependence, there's nothing that stops a private company from saying, hey, I'm going to tow a fresh water supply up from the Antarctic and land it in Cape Town and provide water for a cost of something like, I think it's 5 cents a kiloliter or something like that.
You know, one of the, you say that, and because you talked about Dambisa Moyo, one of the things that I wish we could see more of coming out of our public sector is a different way of solving problems, right? So, for instance, we have all of these people that are sitting on grants that are getting a whatever, R1,200 grant or whatever it is. And yet the expectation from our government is that they're going to shift this money around. So you get money from the Department of Social Welfare, and on the other side, Eskom wants money from you. You know, so instead of coming up with a cohesive kind of strategy that encompasses everything and how we look after our citizens and kind of goes, the healthcare portion of your whatever is X amount of money. And if you have your children vaccinated and, you know, when you get them to the school, you know, your grant then is, this is the value of your grant is then 10,000 Rand, actually. Even though you may not be getting 10,000 Rand in your bank account, that is the value
making
of social support
of how much
that you are receiving because of all of the additional support. But we don't have that kind of thinking. We don't have that solutionist thinking.
No, we need to burn down the schools first until they fix the roads.
It's ridiculous. Like, that for me is ridiculous. It's ridiculous that on the one hand, you give people a social grant, and then on the other hand, you want to take away from the social grant because you're trying to plug another hole somewhere else, instead of kind of looking at it from the top and making the whole puzzle fit together.
All right, Scott says on 0797482090, there are massive gas reserves offshore of South Africa and neighboring countries. It takes a few months to install a gas turbine power station. Cheap, efficient, no pollution, lots of power.
Agreed.
Right. This one's from Duncan. He says, guys, you're wrong about the NHS in Britain. For urgent services like cancer, trauma, mental health, etc., the NHS is probably the best in the world. For minor ailments, you may not get the quickest service, but for everything else, it's perfect. I live here and I can speak from experience. Private healthcare in South Africa is becoming so unaffordable for the regular South African. Even ambulances are limited to a specific medical aid. Please check your facts.
But we need minor health.
Guys, actually, now I'm going to climb in on this with both feet. I literally have family that are working in NHS in the UK. Okay, I'm talking about nieces and nephews who've migrated from here. They're working with the NHS.
Mm-hmm.
And I generally see them whenever I'm up in the UK. It is a flipping disaster. I'm very pleased that this person has had a good personal experience in terms of the NHS. But, you know, rest assured, I had a situation a few years ago where I was feeling out of sorts and I suddenly ended up having word salad. You guys understand how word salad works,
mm-hmm.
where you try to say something and something else comes out of your
almost
mouth.
Almost like when you get a migraine headache and you don't make sense.
Yeah. And you know, it's word salad means that I was trying to say I'm having difficulty coughing, but instead what came out of my mouth was I'd like to have some coffee.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So, you know, so your brain is unable
to... Not connecting completely.
Yes, and
you're discombobulated.
Yes. And went down to my GP, took a look at me, and he says, you are going straight to hospital, bundled me off immediately, diagnosed at the time, preliminary diagnosis that came out from the neurologist who took a look at me was, she said, look, I can't wait for the results of the spinal to come back yet, it looks to me like you've got viral encephalitis. Wow. I'm going to start the treatment immediately.
Right.
Okay, on the assumption that you've got it, even though the results of the spinal have not yet come back.
Right.
Okay, and if I had to wait 3 weeks...
You might have been dead.
I would have been dead.
Yeah, so, I mean, I get what he's saying. Yeah, when you've got cancer, great for you. But actually, most of us have the minor ailments more often. And those are the moments that we need
healthcare. And if they don't get diagnosed.
Well, Duncan does say that, you know, the ambulance thing, that's a serious problem because we do have ambulance shortages in South Africa. And a lot of the ambulances are contracted out. They're private ambulance companies that only do certain jobs. That I think is something we need to consider. But
oh, that's rubbish.
The solution is not to hand this over to Zweli Mkhize to manage.
Again, you know, the solution in that particular case, and using personal example, I was one Saturday morning, this is while the M1 construction was still in place.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday morning, I was out at Neighbor Goods Market having breakfast with a friend, and my wife calls me and says that she's having some sort of palpitations, which is another story by itself, which I'll tell you the punchline later. But and there's construction on the M1, and I know I'm not going to get back in time. And I call, I think it was 082-911, and I say, just get an ambulance to this place. And then, of course, I broke all traffic laws getting there. But the ambulance was already there and treating her by the time I got there, some 20 minutes later.
Yeah, we usually only hear the horror stories.
Yes.
Yeah, and those are the exceptions.
So, you know, again, I'm saying the private sector in this country, it actually works. And by the way, in terms of the palpitations, what had actually happened was that Sarah had eaten one of the brownies that my daughter had made.
Oh, nuts allergy. No?
Different kind of brownies.
Guys.
Different kind of brownies.
Come on, green guys.
Experience. They were weed brownies. Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Yeah,
good
all right.
Morning.
He also says, by the way, Duncan says, I'm a big Bojo fan. It took me a minute to figure out what he meant. Boris Johnson.
Yeah, well, so Bojonomics is now a thing.
I didn't know this. This is news to me. So you see, we can all learn from the Burning Platform. Bojo. Who would have guessed? Bojo fan. All right, thank you very much. That's the end of the Burning Platform for this morning. Kanthan Pillay, thank you. Pumi Mashiho, thank you. Sia Sangweni, thank you. And most especially, thank you for joining us this morning. We will see you again next week on the Burning Platform for some more discussion around this. Send your questions in if you've got something you want us to address. If there's something you'd like to hear Pumi's opinion, Kanthan's opinion on, then send us an email, gareth@cliffcentral.com, and we will put it into our lineup. We'll make sure that you get the answers you deserve. Thank you so much. Have a good day. It's Thursday. Don't work too hard today. Tomorrow's Friday, right?
This is cliffcentral.com.